Despite the strike action, despite the weather, it's my very great pleasure to welcome my friend and colleague Judith Townend to Cambridge. Her topic is a really important one. How do we make courts, we're all sort of lawyers, we're all law related, courts we presumably think pursue a very important function, but how do we ensure that that function and that social activity is transparent for the public? And also, how do we ensure that it's appropriately safeguarded and protecting really fundamental interests from rehabilitation rights through to privacy, through to confidentiality, and also, obviously, data protection rights. Mm. I can't think of anyone better to explore these questions with us than Judith, who's been working for a number of years in this area. So without any further ado, I will hand the floor over to you.
Thank you very much. It's a real privilege to be with you today, despite all the potential obstacles that got in our way. With apparently Dominic Grieve was more of an attractive prospect yesterday, so we moved it to today, and then the strikes and the trains threatened it, but I've made it. Like David said, I've been working on this topic for quite a few years. In some ways, it's always gone in parallel to the research projects I'm working on, but it's an issue that I encounter and I've sort of become quite obsessed and preoccupied by. And it's a genuine conundrum for me. So I raise this as a question, you know, a conundrum of how we balance these particular tensions that David just referenced and thinking about how we deal with them. And my starting position certainly was a lot more black and white, and then over the years, the more people I talk to, the more uncertain I become and the more confused I become in terms of what sort of a perfect balance or a good balance looks like. And every time I speak on this, I'm always encounter different views and experiences, so I'll be very glad to hear from you after the formal bit of this talk. I should say something a little bit about my background. I originally came from the social sciences and then worked in journalism, and that was hence why I had a slightly black and white view at the beginning of all of this, because I sort of thought, well, yes, we have an obvious right to access information from the court. This should be all automatically published online, and we should be able to get it through search easily. And then I think, as I said, as the more people I've talked to and the more I've read, the more I've realised what a complex and difficult area this is. So I'm going to focus today on the courts in England and Wales, obviously that being the jurisdiction that we're in. But I'm very keen to hear about other jurisdictions as well, so perhaps in the discussion, if you've got examples from other countries, I'd really like to hear about them. There's been very little systematic empirical study that looks comparatively at different jurisdictions. So I've picked up bits and pieces here and there, but certainly that's a future project that would be great to do at some point. So I'll just start off with a few basics, which will be familiar to many of you in the room. The notion of the public courtroom is underpinned by the common law principle of open justice. This is an important part of the rule of law, which has evolved from public court gatherings in the Middle Ages and famously articulated as that notion that justice must be seen to be done. And then with the further development of the European Convention on Human Rights, we've seen further protection through Article 6 and Article 10. But generally, the position in England and Wales has been to protect this public access to court through the open justice common law principle. And it's so entrenched in legal culture and legal mindset that, in fact, it's been described as unquestionable. That was Lord Justice Toulson in 2012 in a decision where the Guardian newspaper was applying for access to documents in US extradition proceedings. And Toulson was decided, and then in the Court of Appeal was deciding whether or not they should have this right of access to the documents. You just have to bear that in mind as the context, this idea of the unquestionable principle of open justice. Of course, not everyone does find it unquestionable. Some of you may be familiar with Giaconelli's text on the critique of the public trial, and he certainly has questioned it and questioned whether publicity is always beneficial in terms of the conduct of justice and what it's trying to achieve. So there has been various discussion around the doctrinal approach to open justice. That's not my focus today. I just wanted to sort of mention it as the context. But I just wanted to briefly sketch out some of the rationales that we can attach to the open justice principle. So you can rationalise it in different ways. You can think about open justice achieving fairness, accountability, public scrutiny, performing some kind of public education role, helping public understanding. And so all of those rationales serve some kind of public interest as well as individual interests. They're discussed in various places. Robertson and Nichols' textbook on media law discusses them briefly, although not in great depth. Now, a more, for me, controversial argument, and this is one that's put forward by newspaper columnists and sometimes judges, that this publicness in court, and particularly naming individuals that are involved in court processes, has a deterrence effect. That it stops people being drawn into legal wrongdoing. It deters individuals from committing crimes because of this threat of the being named and shamed. Now, I find that argument quite problematic. I'm less convinced of that rationale, and it's certainly not applying to all circumstances. If we translate that to the civil context, for example, it doesn't really work so well. And I'm yet to see the empirical evidence for that deterrence factor. So Penelope Gibbs, who's a very vocal legal campaigner, doing lots of, at the moment, around the court's reform programme, she's had an issue with when the media has tried to intervene to name, for example, child murderers in case, or people that are children that are on trial for murder. The media has made an intervention to say it's in the public interest to name these individuals. And she said that these cases are so unique and unusual, it's very difficult to see how that name and shame deterrence argument works in that context. And in fact, you know, reading accounts of some high-profile crimes, you might actually think, well, does the possibility of fame and notoriety in some fact might be an incentivising factor rather than a deterrence? That's not a study I've embarked on, but just a thought to throw out there. So the name and shame argument is not a rationale that I'm particularly persuaded by, and I prefer to think about the rationales of accountability and education in terms of understanding why open justice is important. And it might be for those reasons that names and context are needed in order to provide this judicial accountability and public education, albeit that there are very many important exceptions. So this basic principle is that the court door should be open to public observers and to the reporters that act on behalf of the public. And in many circumstances, this is extended to court documentation as well as merely the ability to go and sit in court and observe proceedings. So there are exceptions to the principle of open justice. But as was set out in the seminal case Scott and Scott, they have to be justified by some even more important principle. And most usually this would be where openness would put at risk the proper administration of justice, which is the purpose of the proceedings. So, for example, if we think about misuse of private information cases, if we name certain individuals and we disclose the information that they're trying to protect in the course of those proceedings, that obviously would frustrate the administration of justice in that context. Now, some types of courts involve greater derogations from the ordinary principle and approach of open justice for reasons of personal privacy and domestic privacy. So notably, there we might think about the family courts and the Court of Protection, where they've developed with a very different type of procedure than in the ordinary criminal and civil courts. It's understood that there may be important aspects of privacy to protect in the family court setting. However, even within the ordinary courts, let's take an ordinary Crown Court, we see a varying approach taken to openness and access, and that's been applied in very many different ways, and it can depend on the personnel in the particular court exactly as to what kind of access you get to that court. And that was at least in part recognised by Lord Justice Toulson. So after he had said that the principle of open justice was unquestionable, He said that its practical application may need reconsideration from time to time to take account of the changes in the way in which society and the courts work. Unsurprisingly, there may be differences of view about such matters. So my proposition is that there's been insufficient reconsideration of the open justice principle and not enough evaluation, and the approach of the courts in general has been one that's largely based on assumption rather than any effort to shape the approach that the court takes based on empirical evidence in terms of looking at the impact of openness in society. Furthermore, we have this idea of openness, but in reality it doesn't always work like that. So sometimes it's less of a case of walking through an open door and you actually hit a brick wall. Some of you may have encountered this in a research context. So I first hit this brick wall when I was working in journalism and trying to access basic details about reporting restrictions and realising that the system was very difficult to engage with, that this information wasn't easily available. And as a journalist, you'll quite often find that a lot of journalists sort of build up personal contacts and they learn to navigate their way around the courts. But it takes some time to do that, and that there aren't really very clear and transparent systems in place. And then this brick wall I hit up against again as a researcher, trying to access basic data about court proceedings. So this is data that should be public, but in reality is too costly to access, or it's in an inaccessible format, or it's not really collected or organised in any systematic sort of way. And maybe some of you have encountered that when you're trying to gather data for your projects that you're involved in. The cost factor is a really important one to flag up. Quite a basic thing from a court proceeding, you might think, well, we should be able to get hold of a transcript of the court proceedings. That exists in some countries, have quite developed systems where it's relatively easy to get hold of a transcript from court proceedings. In this country, it's controlled by private companies and it's incredibly expensive to get a transcript. So the cost that's been cited by the Centre for Criminal Appeals, which have been campaigning on this, they've suggested it's up to £20,000 to get a transcript for a 3-week criminal trial. So imagine you're a litigant person, representing yourself. I mean, where would you have access to that kind of money if you haven't got recourse to legal aid and so on? So that system has developed because of the culture, really, the piecemeal and privatised system that governs access to courts data. And private companies have filled an important role in terms of making information available, but it comes at a cost. There are also barriers to members of the media and to the members of the public gathering their own data in the courtroom. So in the last couple of years, there's been a growing number of anecdotal reports by journalism and law lecturers that when they've taken groups of journalism or law students to court, the security staff or court ushers have tried to stop them from taking notes. And this is actually becoming quite a problem. And it might be that the court staff are inadequately trained. They don't know that there actually is unless there's a specific restriction that has been made by the judge, then you should be entitled to sit in court and make notes. Not draw. Drawing is prohibited, but you are allowed to make written notes. I should say there's an exception in the Supreme Court. They didn't actually introduce the anti-drawing rule, so we do have some sketches that have been done from inside the Supreme Court, especially by, there's an artist called Isabel Williams who does some great work from inside the Supreme Court. But in most courts, that would not be permitted. So that's why you get those pastel court sketches. These artists develop the skill to memorise what they've seen in the courtroom and then they go outside and make their drawing. So there is guidance that's been drafted and available to court staff on what the rights are for the media to access the courtroom, but they're not always followed. And furthermore, the rights of ordinary members of the public aren't always considered in such documents. So I mentioned that there can be quite inconsistent practice between courts. And obviously, as I've flagged up already, you have courts of a very different nature and of a very different type. But even within one court type, you might have quite different practice in reality. And we talk about the open justice principle in quite a generalized way. But of course, we have to think about these radical differences and the objectives of the court process, and that maybe we need data systems that are adapted to the particular court type. So again, going back to the family court example, there are going to be very particular and specific concerns that relate to data in a family case, say relating to living and child living and contact arrangements, as compared to a criminal murder trial, as just one example. So some of the differences between the way that courts handle data are sensible, and there are distinctions that need to be made, but we also have much confusion with out-of-date systems, bad technology, inadequate data collection, poor organisation, which leads to unpredictable and mixed experiences for accessing data. Now, at this point, I should probably explain what I mean by courts data and courts access. So in terms of courts access, I've just sort of sketched out those headings there. I guess if we look back to those historical roots of open justice, it was the ability to sit in court, to use your eyes and ears in the courtroom to observe proceedings, and that would be a member of the public. Over time, that perhaps has been taken over by the ability to report proceedings. So we rely on members of the media to act as a sort of a proxy for the public, because practically speaking, most members of the public have got to go to work every day. They're not going to go and sit in court to watch justice being done. So we rely on the media being there and communicating the proceedings on our behalf. Or in the case of academics, you know, we're obviously going to rely on the official law reports and so on to produce information about the court's process that allow us to engage in the process without actually having to travel to court. Journalists get quite excised about the difficulties in verifying basic information about the court proceedings. So verifying a listing, i.e. the basic information about what's coming up in court, that would be the names of the parties, and in a criminal context, the details of the charge. Checking what the actual result of a court case might be. This isn't data that's routinely or systematically published or accessible, and some courts make it more difficult to check that information than other courts. And then I've added ability to access documents. There's more ambiguity around there in terms of what documents you can access, but I think that's an important part of court's access. And then finally, the ability to check a reporting restriction. So if you're in court, do you actually know what you're allowed to report and comment on? Can you check what the restrictions are that are in place? What if the restriction was made on a day when you weren't sitting in court? Can you check that you're not going to be in contravention of that restriction? I'm not going to go through all the different types of restrictions there are, but you will be aware that in various different situations there can be automatic restrictions that apply or ad hoc restrictions that have been granted under various different bits of legislation. And this, as I said, varies between different courts. So in some situations, journalists have managed, have got a good relationship with the court, and they get emailed the court listings every week. Relatively easy for them to look through and to monitor that. On the other end of the scale, I was told a few years ago by a journalist about a situation where a Crown Court in South Wales locked the listings into a metal box and then gave the journalist strict instructions not to open them until they were back into their newspaper office. So there's varying levels of security that are given to these listings. There's also a difference between the basic listing. So if you go into the court, you'll see the notice board, and you just have the very bare bones listing, like the names of the parties in the cases and possibly the brief charge. The journalists are actually entitled to more information, including names and addresses of the defendant, for example. So that would be the information that in that example, the court was so concerned to make sure wasn't opened until they were in the safety of the office. In terms of the types of data, I've mentioned listings, results and outcomes, sentencing remarks. Those aren't routinely published systematically. If the court deems it a particular public interest, the judicial office may make sentencing remarks available on its website. The media may report them if they happen to be in court, but that doesn't necessarily happen. Interestingly, David Lammy MP, who recently conducted a review of the treatment and outcomes for Black, Asian and minority ethnic individuals in the criminal justice system, he actually suggested in his recommendations that sentencing remarks should be more routinely published so that people had access to either an audio or a written transcript of what had been said in the sentencing remarks in criminal cases. I found that quite interesting because he talks about that they should be published in the report. In the same report, he also talks about needing to seal records for individuals and to emulate a US approach to the sealing of criminal records. So that would be a restriction on information. So I thought that was an interesting tension there, where he was pushing for more openness on the one hand, but also thinking about appropriate restrictions in another context. And these are the sorts of conundrums that we constantly find ourselves up against. Court judgments. I imagine you're all very familiar with accessing court judgments for your research. This is many, if not all judgments, or not all judgments, but many judgments are published to the service Bailey, also via the commercial legal providers, and then obviously sometimes individual sites and blogs will upload copies of judgments. But we don't always aren't able to access a written judgment easily, and practice is variable. In the family court, there's been a push for publishing more and more judgments, but we know that only a fraction of all the judgments are actually published. Transcripts I've mentioned. Skeleton arguments. David and I were just having a chat about this before we came in. Theoretically public, I think there's some ambiguity there exactly as to how they should be handled, but you don't necessarily have a right of access to get them from the court itself, but you could talk to the lawyers involved in the case to see if they'll kindly share the skeleton arguments with you. But there's some ambiguity about how they could be used and how public that they are. Claim forms and civil proceedings. Theoretically, these are available, but at a cost. So in the context of media cases, which is my research area, I wanted to look at all the claim forms for defamation cases over a year period, but it would have been totally unaffordable for me to do that because each claim form for one case costs £10 for the first 10 pages, 50p for every page thereafter. So if you added that up for all the cases in 1 year, at the time that was for my PhD research, that was well beyond the budget of my PhD scholarship. So I had to abandon that idea. And then I've mentioned reporting restrictions there. The media have frequently complain that they should have some kind of way of accessing these live reporting restrictions and finding out what reporting restrictions are in place, and there were suggestions that some kind of database should be created. The outcome of that was a private contractor quoted a huge amount that the media organisations would have to pay for it, so at that point the idea basically died. The Law Commission looked at it a few years ago and suggested quite a simple system for just documenting and making lists of reporting restrictions available, not necessarily the full detail of the reporting restriction, but just a list showing you when reporting restrictions were in place for a certain type of restriction. These were Section 4.2 contempt of court postponement orders. And I thought, and at the time I commented that I thought it was a sensible idea, but the government has not been inclined to act on the proposal, so as far as I know, nothing's happened with that. So moving on. So this is kind of the mess, the context of court's data. Hopefully now you've got the message. It's inconsistent, it's messy, it's not systematic. So you would think it's an ideal time to address this as part of the massive programme of courts modernisation that's going on in the UK right now. This is a £1 billion reform programme, looking at the introduction of better technological processes in the courtroom, and a huge amount of resources being put towards that. I should say that is actually in the context of cuts to the MOJ budget, though. The latest budget revealed a £600 million cut to the budget by 2019-2020. So although there is investment, I think the overall objective is to bring costs down for the court service And currently, the court service is consulting on the closure of a number of physical court buildings around the country. So, in this programme of reform, the court service are taking what's called an agile approach. They're testing, rolling it out in bite-sized chunks. Now, that does seem sensible. I can sort of see the logic for doing it like that. The only problem is that when you're doing things in those that bite-sized way, it means that ideas aren't always put to full public scrutiny before they're sort of quietly introduced, which means that there can be a lack of full and proper public consultation. And there's a question of about whether legislation is being bypassed, when really it should be, some of these reforms should be given a legislative basis. And if legislation is bypassed, then we miss an opportunity for public accountability. So I mentioned Penelope Gibbs earlier, legal campaigner, and so she's raised these issues that she's very concerned about the lack of public consultation, the lack of active parliamentary scrutiny. And the HMCTS have talked to people that they know of, like kind of key stakeholders. There's been limited opportunity for kind of widespread public consultation. So there was a courts bill, the Prison and Courts Bill 2016, which introduced a number of innovations in this context. However, due to the timing of the general election, that was then abandoned pre-general election. So we never saw that bill formally go any further. So the Queen's speech last year mentioned another courts bill, but we haven't seen it yet. So what's happening in the meantime is the court service is proceeding with its programme of reform, but without any new draft primary legislation. And there's a, or I've just, there is a consultation out at the moment on these closures of the courts. I'm trying to think if I can shoehorn some of my views into that consultation, but they're not really asking the questions I want them to ask. So, as yet, there has been no full public consultation on the notion of access to courts or open justice. It's all being done in much more piecemeal chunks. So, in terms of how the courts are being modernised, this is the move from physical court proceedings into digital settings. And we're a little bit behind in the UK. Some countries have been innovating in this area to a much greater extent for far longer. It's taken the UK a little, or especially in England and Wales, a little longer to get to this point. So some of this is about internal data management, so through the Common Platform programme, which is around how data is internally shared within the process. Some of this is about digitising civil claim procedures, the introduction of online dispute resolution. So some of those media cases that I'm interested in may in future be resolved through online interactions rather than in open physical court hearings. The increasing use of virtual hearings, so where you would have all the parties participating by video link rather than being in the courtroom together. So obviously there, we can immediately think about, well, what about public access to those proceedings? If it's all, everyone's in the, you know, the judges in everyone's sitting in their own office or home, how does a member of the public observe that? And one proposal that's come out so far is that the courtrooms will have video terminals where the journalist or a member of the public can go and watch the video terminal in the courtroom. So the only people who would be going to the physical court are the observers, and then everyone else is sitting at home. It's, yeah. They haven't said how many of these video terminals there will be, and I'm not sure whether they're really thinking that they would introduce them in every single court around the country. In order to make sure that people don't abuse this access, they're suggesting that there would need to be some kind of security presence, so it will be prohibited that if you were watching the video terminal, you couldn't then record it on your mobile phone and upload it to the internet or something like that. So lots of questions around that proposal. But a lot of vagueness as well. So in terms of what they're thinking about for access, I've had a few meetings with the MOJ, and they did have one open justice roundtable where different stakeholders were invited. And they've recently set up a new working group for journalists and for the court service to discuss issues for the media. When I found out about that, I did hint that I was quite interested, but as yet, I'm still waiting for my invitation, so we'll see. But really, it's been a question of sort of trying to pick up bits from people who have been involved in the discussions, trying to get the information as far as possible through personal contacts, but really very little published online about the access plans. So, for example, in the Prison and Courts Bill, there were plans that were detailed in that bill for online pleadings. So someone could, you just go onto an online process and plead guilty rather than actually having to visit the courtroom physically. And they were suggesting that that would be introduced just for minor offences such as rail fare offences. And then it was just mentioned in an impact assessment, results will be published online. Which to me was very interesting because we don't have any systematic publishing of results for other sorts of criminal cases, so very much more serious offences, and yet potentially we could have a very a systematic set of results data for these very minor offences, which seemed to me a funny contradiction, or would be a sort of a funny situation. And then we meet those frictions that we've been talking that we talked about at the beginning in terms of privacy, data protection, rehabilitation. If this kind of data is made routinely and systematically available on the open web, how do we balance that with these other rights? So, maybe some of you in the room here, and certainly I know David is, are far more expert on data protection than me. And I've sort of been dipping my toe in this area, just sort of trying to work out what's going on. One problem is that I'm not even 100% sure of what the status quo is, let alone what changes are coming with the GDPR and the Data Protection Bill in terms of the handling of court's data. So what responsibility in terms of data protection does the court service have in the context of data protection? So some matters seem to be handled at a regional level and some are centrally controlled. There is a document that talks about guidance for judicial office holders with relation to data protection and information security, which was acquired via a Freedom of Information request in 2016. And that currently is the updated guidance pre-GDPR, pre-Data Protection Bill. And I'm part of a charity called the Transparency Project. They mainly do stuff in the family courts, but we also think about courts access more broadly. And it was one of the members of the Transparency Project had noticed that there were some judgments that had been released with unredacted data. So names that were subject to a reporting restriction that shouldn't have been in the judgment but were in there. And so that prompted an inquiry into the court as to how that is managed, and those judgments were very swiftly removed once the court was alerted to that incident. But we were quite interested into what the protocol and the data protection procedure was in that context, and that's how we got hold of this guidance. And that guidance suggests that there are these different units within the court service and the MOJ, a data access and compliance unit, an information assurance and data security team, and that there is a process for judicial office holders. So if the judicial office holder received a subject access request under the Data Protection Act, they were told that they should go and talk to the court service knowledge and information liaison officers to deal with that. And the ICO, in a relatively recent decision, said that the data, this judicial data that people might be entitled to under subject access requests, could include a judge's handwritten notes that had been played that were part of the formal court file. But generally, I think it's been fairly unknown exactly what individual rights are in relation to data protection for courts data. So moving on from that relatively unclear process, I then thought, well, obviously there's going to be implications from the GDPR and the Data Protection Bill that's currently passing through Parliament. So clause 117 in the current version of the bill says that supervisory authority, or this reflects GDPR Article 55, which says that supervisory authorities shall not be competent to supervise processing operations of courts acting in their judicial capacity. So it doesn't mean the judiciary are necessarily exempt from data protection, but that they aren't subject to that supervisory oversight, i.e. the ICO or the commissioner. So my question there is, well, how will that affect oversight of data protection in the court's context, and how will that be provided for? So I've been doing my best to try and get some information about the response from the court service and the judiciary to the GDPR, and really I want to get them to set out, you know, what's the status quo is, and then what are the things that they'll need to change in view of the GDPR. So I've had some helpful communication with the ICO and a little bit with the Judicial Office. The court service response to the implications of the GDPR were no comment. I personally didn't think it was that unreasonable to ask them to talk about their preparation and their response to GDPR, given that the Culture Minister is telling everyone that all organisations need to be GDPR ready. I thought the government departments might need to say something on that as well, but apparently, that was they didn't take that view. But I will try and pursue that communication and try and find someone to talk to in the court service. The Judicial Office confirmed that it has got a working group which has been set up, and they are discussing compliance with the GDPR and the Data Protection Bill, and that they're currently consulting the judiciary, and they'll be revising policy guidance in order to meet the requirements and standards of the GDPR and of the bill. And then they explained that with respect to the processing of judicial and courts data, they flagged up that it's relevant to the implications of Recital 20 of the GDPR, which in principle entrusts the supervision of data processing in a judicial capacity to the judiciary, and that the EU rationale for that originated in the need to safeguard the independence of judges in the performance of their judicial tasks. But crucially, they clarified that while the law prescribes for separate supervision, the judiciary are not exempt from the application of the substantive rules on data protection. So my question really here is, how will data protection regulation be enforced for anything that's understood to fall outside this supervisory authority for personal data processing by an individual that's acting in judicial capacity or a court or tribunal acting in its judicial capacity? And what does that mean? So the court service will still handle the court file in a case, so potentially you could still have certain rights through the court service. So where the dividing line becomes between what data is handled in the judicial capacity and what data is handled through the MOJ and the court service. What about records that are not added to the formal file, or data that's relating to a case that a judge is carrying around on their personal electronic device? These things interest me. So where will exemptions apply? And if you did want to pursue action under data protection regulation, then would you have to go via the civil and the criminal courts rather than having any supervisory authority to complain to in the first instance? The other relevant bit to mention is Clause 43 of the Data Protection Bill, which limits the rights of individuals to the extent that subject access rights, right to rectification, erasure, and restriction of processing do not apply in relation to the processing of relevant personal data in the course of criminal proceedings. So the provision only applies when the judge or other judicial authority is the controller and the relevant personal data is contained in a judicial decision or in other documents which are created during a criminal investigation made on behalf of the judge or the judicial authority. So there we could have some important and significant exemptions in that context. So I'd be very pleased to hear your thoughts in terms of these particular aspects of the Data Protection Bill and any other aspects of the GDPR that may be relevant. My last bit on data protection is just to flag up the significance of the right to be forgotten. And there's two cases, really interesting cases going through the High Court at the moment, NT1 and NT2, which concern the processing of data about spent convictions under the Rehabilitation of Offenders Act 1974. So the claimants are challenging Google's refusal to delist search results which contain information about their historical criminal convictions on data protection grounds. And they're, of course, relying on the European Court of Justice's decision in Google Spain and Costello González, which the last time I was in this faculty, it was an entire day's discussion around that case. and so we're obviously still seeing the ramifications and implications playing out in the courts now. So those obviously concern Google's processing of the data rather than the court at source. It's not the court's processing of the data. But I feel it shows a change in direction of travel, the fact that these cases are now starting to come through. And surely at some point the court will have to address the question of its own role in that, in the process of publication and dissemination of personal data relating to court proceedings. So, of course, with data protection, we often think about freedom of information legislation as going hand in hand. When I've talked on this subject before, I'm asked, well, what about freedom of information? Why can't you use that to get hold of this data? Well, that's because there's a pretty clear exemption in Section 32, an absolute exemption for court records. So if you wanted to get any court record via the Freedom of Information Act, that wouldn't be a viable route for you. You can get some information that's related to the court and to judicial proceedings, say statistical information, for example, but you wouldn't be able to get the records themselves. Now, one of the justifications for that exemption, and I haven't yet actually gone back to the full policy discussion at the time, it's something that I keep meaning to do, but one of the justifications is, well, open justice provides for that, so that it wasn't needed in freedom of information. And it was better to rely on the open justice principle. But as I hope I've illustrated, there are things that are not provided by the open justice approach in terms of the practical provision of information. So here we have a situation where neither FOI or open justice is providing the access to which the public is entitled. So it will be interesting to see whether we get any challenge to that absolute exemption at some point. We're seeing a growing body of case law which is further establishing the right to receive information under the convention, under the European Convention, where the right to receive information is seen as instrumental to an individual's freedom of expression, and any interference with that could be seen as a violation of Article 10. So whether that could be challenged on Article 10 grounds at some time would be interesting to see. So I'm aware of these tensions, and I'm not making an argument that everything should just be published wholesale to the open web. So what I'll set out now, just in sort of to conclude the presentation, is to think about what the case is for having more public courts data, and then think about how it should be practically applied. So I do think we need to engage with Article 10 here and a public right to receive information. If we're wholly reliant on the media to provide information, it is obviously driven by certain news agendas and quite a limited focus, whereas a public right to receive information could be much broader. I think these rationales that I mentioned at the beginning for accountability, education and scrutiny are important in terms of achieving open justice and understanding why open justice is important. We're seeing a decline of traditional media reporting. So newspapers, whilst some are still making fairly healthy revenues, it's sort of we know that there is a financial problem for many newspapers, and they've pulled back from many of the public interest type roles that they used to perform, with fewer court reporters, fewer specialist legal correspondents. So it means that we can no longer, if we ever could, wholly rely on traditional media to perform that role. And we have seen a rise in alternative public watchdogs. Academics are increasingly blogging. Lawyers are increasingly blogging. There is this is a, one real positive that's come out in this in the last 10 years is that we have these other people doing public scrutiny of the courts, and that they should be recognised in the open justice context. So that's the sort of the case for public courts data, but I do think that we have to think about how it's done. It has to be high quality and it has to be in customised formats. So obviously the data needs to be accurate, it needs to be appropriately released, it needs to be systematically released, but it has to be done in ways that do respect rehabilitation and privacy rights. So one thing that I've started to come round to and think about a bit more is the possibility of access. So the courts systematically make access possible to certain documents, but that doesn't necessarily mean publishing everything to the open web. But it does mean, for example, let's take the sentencing remarks example, that if you were an individual involved in a case, you would be able to access your sentencing remarks. That wouldn't be impossible, as it is in many situations now. But it doesn't necessarily mean that everything has to be published to the open web. So, but I can't talk too generalised away. It's going to very much depend on the particular data set that we're talking about, the particular courts, and then designing an appropriate access mechanism in that context. So my wish list for going forward is that we have a more nuanced and educated approach to open justice that actually looks at empirical evidence, that thinks about ways of developing an appropriate system in the digital era, that we think about the importance of access for people that are not just journalists, but also NGOs and researchers. Journalists do enjoy a certain number of privileges in the court context, but I think some of those should be extended to other people that can demonstrate that they are acting in the public interest. So, for example, in the family court, only accredited reporters with a press card get automatic right of entry to the family court, but people, lawyers, and NGOs and other people doing work in that context don't necessarily have that right of access. I think we need more research on the implications of changes for all types of court users. So I've got a little pilot project that I'm doing at the moment that's trying to think about people who are mentioned in courts data, the subject of courts data, how do they feel about the publication and the dissemination of courts data? And that's a question that I haven't really seen interrogated in either the academic literature or in any of the policy discussions that are going on at the moment. And I've probably said this point enough already, but there should be public consultation on the way that we access court. Let's hear what people think about it, how court records should be managed in a digital environment. One idea that I've been sort of playing around with and developing that originally came from Jason Bosland working at the University of Melbourne is looking at the idea of having some kind of advocate. Open justice advocate was his original idea, and we're just developing that at the moment, thinking about whether a public interest advocate or some kind of neutral ombudsman in the court setting could mediate and intervene in these circumstances where, for example, there isn't media interest, but there might be a public interest in looking at the access issues. And one point there to think about is, like, would they just make interventions from the open justice point of view, or might they also be someone that you could appeal to on privacy grounds and say, well, actually, it needs to be restricted in this context? Because at the moment, it's a very patchwork and piecemeal system as to whether or not an intervention gets made in a court setting. So that's a piece that I'm working on at the moment, and hopefully the paper will be published in a few months' time. So I spoke at the National Association of Data Protection Officers annual conference earlier in the year, and I mentioned my wish list. At that point, it was a Christmas wish list. And I was, someone in the audience said, oh, you have to be very careful what you wish for. And that there may be some unintended side effects of what I'm asking for. Maybe we don't want to look at this too closely. And I don't think that's reasonable, really. I think there already are so many inconsistencies at the status quo, and I think that these issues are too complex and too important to duck any longer, and we need to tackle them head on. And it may be uncomfortable, but that's a conversation that needs to happen. Thank you.